White Rocket Entertainment.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment, along with people like you via Patreon.com. Well, I just got back from Dragon Con 2017, and I recorded several panels there. Really cool stuff on a lot of topics. For this episode, we present the Roger Zelazny panel. This is a panel where I, along with James Palmer, Bill Rich, and S.M. Sterling, who will all introduce themselves in just a moment, talked about the life and work of my favorite author, Roger Zelazny. If you enjoy this show, please consider helping out joining the White Rocket Entertainment family by going to patreon.com, patreon.com, and becoming a member. For as little as a dollar a month, you can help us continue to produce shows like the one you are about to hear, and we really appreciate it. And as always, we thank Nicholas Cottrell, David Medinas, Mark Squire, Dave Powell, Jared Albrick, Rich Reimer, Michael Kirshner, Bill Matthews, Joey Miller, Matthew Wagstaff, Chris Thrash, Wes Atkinson, J.W. Rice, Phil Amthor, Randall Walker, Richard Stevens, and War Damn Wade, as well as our anonymous one-time contributors. All of you folks are enormously appreciated for what you do to help us stay on the air. So, without further ado, live from the Sci-Fi Lit Track at DragonCon 2017, here is the Roger Zelazny panel. All right, well, we are here to remember Roger Zelazny, and I'm going to try to talk loud because we discovered last night, if not before, the microphones aren't fantastic in here. So we'll just, if you need to come closer to be able to hear, I'm sorry. It's just kind of how the technology in this room is. But we're here to remember Roger Zelazny and talk about his life and his work. It's a good time to do it. Let me kind of lead off with this real quick, guys, and I'll let you guys introduce yourself. But it's a good time to do it for one reason, is because last year was the 20th anniversary of his passing. Right, and we did a little memorial, and now we're looking back at his work and everything. And also, there's talk of a TV show of Amber coming along, some other stuff maybe in the works. And finally, Trent Zelazny, his middle child, and the one that's a burgeoning sci-fi fantasy writer as well, Trent co-edited with Warren Lapine this new book that is just now coming out. I have an advanced copy here called Shadows and Reflections, which is stories from the worlds of Roger Zelazny. So Zelazny's kind of percolating along. This book is, it's got who you'd expect, like Stephen Bruce and George R. R. Martin involved in it, who were both very close to him. Jane Linscold, of course, who was with him when he died. Shannon Zelazny has a sort of a little epitaph at the end. Michael Hansen, who, these are all folks that are very, Theodore Krulik, they're all very associated with him. But it's what they did is they took, each of them took a different one of his worlds and wrote a story set in it. So there's like a Lord of Light story, there's a Creatures of Light and Darkness story, there's a Doorways in the Sand story, everything except Amber, because that one they felt like he had specifically said, don't do that. So they didn't do that, and of course Trent being involved wasn't going to let them do that. So I promised Warren if he would send me a copy, I would wave it around and talk about it briefly. So now you know about it, and now I get me a book. So it works. It's a win-win, right? So
now you can order yours.
Yes, there you go.
When's it coming out?
It's any day now. It may already be out, in fact. I just got one before they released it, so I've had it for about a month.
Shadows and Reflections?
Shadows and Reflections, edited, forwards by George R. R. Martin. Really nice. I did read the forward where he's talking about how his relationship with Zelazny, first on a professional level and then later on a friend level. It's really interesting. In fact, I think that George, you know, the Game of Thrones writer, yeah, George was a person who carried him to the hospital the last time that he didn't come back from. So that's fascinating to realize that. Okay, so let's introduce ourselves. Let's start down at the end with Mr. Sterling.
Okay, I'm Steve Sterling, S.M. Sterling. I live in Santa Fe, where Roger lived.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I moved there the month he died. Everyone said, you've got to meet Roger, but, you know, he was very ill. I've been reading his stuff for a long time, and I've known people who knew him well. Jane Linscold is a close friend. I know George socially, too. And he left a big impact. And I've been influenced by his work, of course. And he was always doing something fresh. One of his later books, A Night in Lonesome October, which is one of my favorites of his, although it's hard to hard to have a favorite considering all the things he did, was written from the viewpoint of Jack the Ripper's dog.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to respect a guy who can write a book from the viewpoint of Jack the Ripper's dog. You know, and the hilarious resurrector scene where they're going snacks and throwing organs back and forth to each other. And the magnificent line where someone asks a cat why they did something. And the cat says, I am a cat and it pleases me to be arbitrary.
Yes.
So, just had to say that.
I'm William Allen Rich, and I unfortunately never got to meet Roger Zelazny. I don't think I ever attended too many conventions he was at, and he was too far above me when I was in college going to conventions and things like that. I remember reading him when I was in mostly junior high and high school, reading him in fantasy and science fiction, and a lot of his short stories, and then some of his novels as they came out. I think the Call Me Conrad, which was This Immortal?
Yes.
Came out in Ace Books and all that, and I have all these ancient editions of books that I've read of him, so I've been a fan of Zelazny for a long time, and I'm sorry I never got to meet him. And my claim to fame is I'm the president of the Atlanta Radio Theater Company.
I'm James Palmer. I write science fiction and pulp adventure. This is my space opera series here. I've got them up here. I first encountered Zelazny through his couple of his very famous short stories, He Who Shapes and The Doors of His Face, The Lamps of His Mouth. And then the first novel I read of his was Lord of Light. And last Halloween, I went through each day of Halloween and read A Night in the Lonesome October. Because
mm-hmm.
Each chapter is, like chapter one is October 1st, and then it goes on through. Great, fun October Halloween thing to do, if you're so inclined. And I'm working my way through the Amber books. I just finished The Hand of Oberon, like, 3 weeks ago.
You're experiencing them for the first time, man.
Yes.
I can't. Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've read them so many times. I was going to say, I'll introduce myself. The thing about Amber, though, to me, is that the first time I read those books was just a miraculous experience. And every time I've gone back and reread them so many times, and every time it never lets me down. It just makes me happy all over again. It's, you know, some things don't hold up, you know, or some things are not as good as you remember. Or maybe when you get older, your tastes change or whatever. No, it's never. It's just gotten better. It just gets better. I find new stuff every time because, like, the first time you read it, you're reading it for plot. You know, the second time maybe for character. The third time for the details. And you just every time you find something different. So,
mm-hmm.
I'm Van Allen Plexico, and I write. I'm a professor of history and political science at Southwestern Illinois. But I write pulp, as we call it. I write science fiction, fantasy, superheroes, all that kind of stuff. The two that I brought for this panel, because they're the most, Roger Zelazny's writing is in my DNA, has been since before, you know, since ninth grade, when I first read Nine Princes and Amber. Everything I write has got, to some degree, Roger Zelazny, maybe a little bit of Jim Starlin, maybe a little bit of Dan Abnett, but Roger Zelazny is, and maybe a little Jack Kirby, but Roger Zelazny, and so these two books are in my series that is really an homage in some ways to Zelazny. It's about immortal characters with unreliable narratives, you know. So, in fact, let me tell you really quick, and I don't mean to be about myself, but just for a second, I was in my autograph line last year here, and a guy came up and he pulled these two books out of his bag, and I said, "Oh, did you get those from me at a convention or something?" He said, "No, I just ordered them on Amazon." He said, "A friend of mine told me that you write just like Zelazny," and I'm like, "Oh, right." He says, "Well, I ordered these to prove him wrong, and I read them, and you do." And I fell down on the floor, and I hugged that guy and kissed him. So trust what he said, Zelazny fans. All right. So let's talk about Roger now. I think I want to start out, because again, last year we talked a lot about him and stuff, and it was really good. But let's talk about some of his works. Let's go down the line, starting with Steve, and say, what is your favorite Zelazny of any size work? It could be a series, it could be a little short story, a page, whatever. And why?
Oh, my God. Yeah. Well, I have to say that, you know, overall my favorite work of his is Lord of Light. Mm-hmm. You know, the combination of mythology and science fiction, I thought, was just handled in a masterful fashion. And, yes, but he preferred to be called Sam.
Yes.
But, you know, Zelazny can be appreciated on a lot of levels. He was a very tight plotter. Even his biggest works, the plot is surprisingly tightly crafted.
Yep.
He can do sprawl and tight at the same time, which is remarkable, and Lord of Light is an example of that. It's sort of episodic, and it has a climax, and then it has a false climax, and then a climax, which is just handled in a masterful fashion. But Zelazny was really good at the telling incident that stays with you, mm-hmm. too. Because one of the Dilvish stories, the character is Dilvish the Damned, and Dilvish has been captured, and he's hung up by the wrists in a dungeon with a bunch of other people, and every once in a while a demon comes into the dungeon, grabs someone out of their chains and eats them. You know, and this has just happened, and they're all hanging in their chains looking at each other. And Dilvish looks at the other prisoners and says, "Here's my plan."
I've seen that cartoon.
Yeah. And, you know, it works. It's not just a contrived.
Yeah.
His plan is to draw a demon trap on the dirt floor of the dungeon with their toes and then cover it over with straw so that they'll catch the demon next time he comes in. And, it works. But there's another bit in the Dilvish series where... The hero has come in and he's found the evil magician, and the evil magician is about to sacrifice a virgin, and the virgin has a dotted line drawn down the center of her body, and there's a big heap of dung, and bats and rats and various creatures are capering about, and there's a bottomless pit, and the Dilvish says, "I thought I'd find you like this, next to a big heap of shit, a bottomless pit, vermin dancing around, and you're about to cut out a girl's heart." And the magician looks at him and says, "These are a few of my favorite things."
So Roger.
You know, so Roger. Yeah, that just stays with you, you know.
I think my favorite single work is Lord of Light, which was a revelation when I was reading it in high school. It's like, wait, I think this is about a religion that I know nothing about, you know, which is what it was. And I was like, I had the taste of it, and I didn't know anything about Hinduism and the gods of the Indians, and I just went along with it as a science fantasy, and it got really interesting. And then years later, I read it again. I went, oh my, you know, there's things I didn't know that I learned in college, and it's like, it was very interesting. But probably my favorite stuff to read in general is of course the Amber series, because it's a lot of fun. It has one of my absolute favorite ways of traveling between worlds.
Yes.
You just start walking and the worlds change around you because you have that power. Mm-hmm. To a large degree, I think that got used by, what was the series I just read that was...
Was it Charles Strauss?
Charles Strauss's Merchant Prince series.
He
admits it. Yeah, it's a great bit because the people can transfer universes just because they can, and they just walk from one place to the other.
Yeah.
It's really fascinating.
Well, and Strauss's stuff too. You know the Amberites have the pattern,
mm-hmm.
and then Strauss's characters look at a pattern.
Mm-hmm.
On a wall, or they have a locket around their neck, and then that transports them to their world, to their universe.
Right.
So it's very cool.
But what's forgotten a lot is that Zelazny was also a really excellent bon mot short story writer. Mm-hmm. You know, he would write a short story, and it would say everything, and it would mm-hmm. be just wonderful. Doors of his face, lamps of his mouth, you know, and a lot of the stuff that he later turned to novels, but were just great as novelettes and short stories, as we talked about yesterday, short stories. And so that's some of my stuff. Those are my favorite things.
Yeah, I have to echo what you guys said. Lord of Light is not only my favorite Zelazny novel, but probably one of my top 10 favorite novels ever. My favorite Amber book would probably be The Guns of Avalon, because that just has everything in it. It has science fiction and fantasy and alternate universes.
And Jeweler's Rouge.
And Jeweler's Rouge.
The idea of a fantasy character with a sword assaulting a fantasy castle with demonic aliens with machine guns.
Yes.
Yes.
When I was in high school reading that, I'm like, oh my God, this is the greatest thing I've ever heard of in my life. I just can't fathom it being better than this.
Yeah. Because those first two books, I mean, they start out, you think it's one thing, and it's science fiction, and mm-hmm. then it turns into fantasy.
Mm-hmm. About the time that Uncle Whatever's Kentucky Fried Lizards or whatever shows up on the road.
Right.
Well, the giant oven that throws people in to cook them or whatever.
Well, see, I was a chemistry major, and the idea that gunpowder doesn't work in this world, but if you have Jeweler's Rouge, that would be works as gunpowder in this world. But the laws of chemistry are different because the physics are different and you know, different wavelengths and stuff like that. So I can buy that. I can buy that easily.
And he just happened. He's like the only Amberite to have ever figured it out because he was polishing a jewel he was going to give to his sister.
And it blew up.
Who he has an interesting relationship with. The Targaryens would love Corwin's family. And and it throws it in the fireplace and it blows up. And he's like, dude, I've got an edge. Yeah, I love it. You know, by the way, you're talking about Lord of Light. Before I give you mine, there is one story, and I don't know if this is true or not, if you guys happen to know or not, but I have heard it said that he claimed at one point, he probably was kidding, but I've heard it said that he claimed at one point he wrote Lord of Light entirely just so he could use that pun.
Yep.
Now, it would be funny if he wrote his greatest work, one of the great works of science fiction, just to put the most god-awful, horrible pun in all of it. You guys want to talk about the pun? I don't want to spoil it if you...
Yes.
Yeah, the... All right, well, it's not really a spoiler since the book has been out since the 60s, okay? Since the first season of Star Trek.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, there's a character called the Shan, which is kind of like the Shah. All the way through, I kept thinking, why is he calling him the Shan and not the Shah, right? But he's like a satrap guy.
Potentate.
And what they do is they put your intelligence into another body to reincarnate you. They use technology to simulate this religion, and so... He gets put into the body of somebody with epilepsy, basically, mm-hmm. and it was part of this plan to infiltrate someplace. It's been years since I read it, but anyway, everything was going great, and then
Sam's in a vehicle chasing him, and a vehicle, and the vehicle's called a Fit,
and then the
and they then the hit each other.
Then the Fit hit the Shan.
The Fit hit the Shan. Yeah. And it's like, it's hundreds of pages into the book.
Yes.
It's a throwaway thing. Like, if you're reading it fast, you'll miss it.
When I read that, I stopped and went, seriously?
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's really? The thing is, he had a wry sense of humor in his serious books, you know, so you're going along with death and, you know, and...
All the big themes.
And it's sort of like if you're reading Martin's Game of Thrones books and there's puns and jokes in it, which there aren't for the most part.
It's just pretty much death.
Yes. Except Tyrion, he's funny, but he's funny in a really nasty way. So
a bunch of bad stuff has happened to me, and here's my reaction to it. It's like Hawkeye. He's basically Hawkeye and MASH. Yeah. Bad stuff, so I'm going to be funny.
But I think Zelazny... Delaney's a completely different great writer. Has been influenced by his wry, wicked sense of humor
a lot,
and we enjoy that. That's one of the things we like in his books. And I was trying to remember one of his more obscure books that I have. I read Shadrach in the Furnace,
I don't think that's his
best book, but I remember reading it, and it's like this is really good. And I of course. I, being a very poorly brought up Baptist, did not know who Shadrach was, except of course by you know the story. I never knew him by name and all that. It's like it's because it's some guy's put in the furnace for his beliefs and
Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego.
See.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Which I first learned about, I think, in a Mark Twain novel, like Huck Finn or something, mentions them.
Yep.
I think my favorite work is probably, I'm going to say Nine Princes in Amber, just because I've read it so many times. I love it so much. It's so influential to me. But the last time through that I read the Amber series was about 2 years ago. And the one that really jumped out at me this time, and I appreciated more, was The Courts of Chaos. And it's interesting because that book has a very checkered history to it. You know, he was originally going to write three, and he was originally going to write three for the Merlin series, too.
Yep.
And it ended up dragging out a little longer than he expected because, you know, I can find the exact moment in The Guns of Avalon, the second book, where all of a sudden he goes, you know what, I know who Ganelon is now. You know, and when he thinks of that and changes it in the story kind of gets bigger. It quits being about Corwin versus Eric, and it starts being about the Amber guys versus Chaos, which really didn't come into play. It kind of, the story evolves and gets kind of like Lord of the Rings. It starts out kind of small, and it kind of grows like that as it goes along. And so so he got to the end of the fourth one, and there was, I don't know the specific, there was issues with the publisher and this, that, and the other. It doesn't really matter. But he ended up, he wasn't even going to write the last one, and he had to kind of wrote it under protest in a hurry, and that's why Courts of Chaos is shorter, and it kind of just brings things to a quick end. It's still great, though. But what I love about it is it's pretty much a travelogue, right? From start to finish, it's Corwin on that road, traveling through all those bizarre dimensions, encountering strange talking birds and talking stone monoliths and stuff, and all those weird things that happen to him along the way, and then he draws his own pattern while he's imagining the Champs-Élysées in the spring and all that, and all that stuff is just so lyrically done. It's just so really beautifully done. As far as his short stuff, I've always really loved The Great Slow Kings. It's the story of like the two big like dinosaur creatures that rule this planet, and they move so incredibly slow that a normal like you and I couldn't perceive they're even alive or moving. So they have these servants that are robots, because the robots can live long enough to actually serve them and talk slow enough to communicate with them. And it's really a short story, but as it goes along, he'll start a conversation with a robot, and then by the time of the second sentence, robot's like, oh, I'm like the 50th robot. The other 49 have already rusted and fallen apart. I'm just picking up where they left off, you know. So what did you need me to do, you know? And like, you know, at one point he's like, oh, there's some microbes over here. I wonder what will happen to them. And the robot comes and says, they've already formed a spacefaring civilization and left the planet. You know, it's so cool how you get all this stuff happening in the course.
It's like a story about relativity.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's what to us seems like, you know, like that. Is there anything he ever did that disappointed you more than, you know, and you kind of left thinking, oh, I wish he could have done different or better, anything like that? Steve, you want to start back again? This may be a short topic, who knows?
Well, I like all the Dulvish stories, but the later ones are much later, and they don't have quite the mythic flavor of the first stories. Dulvish the Damned.
Mm-hmm.
And the later ones are more pulpy, and they're a lot of fun. They're great fun, but they don't have quite the resonance of the first ones, in my opinion.
Which brings me to a question I wanted to ask you. So, are there 5 Amber books or 10?
Oh, there's 10.
I know. That,
there's just 5 that are a little better and 5 that are not quite as good.
See, in your mind, are there 5 or 10?
The what now?
In your mind, in your head, you go, the 5 Amber, because you said, and then I finished up with
you like
Courts
them
of
all,
Chaos.
Don't you?
I like them all, but this reading through, I found it was a little tougher to get through Merlin, because with Corwin, it's just, there's always an imperative. There's always an imperative. Merlin kind of like, la, 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 is his way through a lot of them, and you kind of go, come on. Let's get a crisis going on here.
Did he maybe just write those for the money more than because he wanted to?
He might have stretched it out for that. It was going to be 3
All writers write for the money.
Sure.
You know. Well, but once, you know, the popularity, and when are you going to do another one, and when are you going to do another one, and he said, okay, I'll do another one.
Well, I think he needed to get to figuring out what happened to Corwin. And, I mean, to me, that was what was disappointing about the Merlin books the first time I read them. And knowing, of course, the answer, I enjoyed them more the second time. But the first time through the Merlin books, I was disappointed because I'm like, where's Corrin show up? When does Corrin show up? When does Corrin show up? And if all you're doing reading those books is waiting for Corrin to show up, it's going to be a while.
Yeah, you're going to be...
You're going to be reading. And then when he finally does show up, you're going to be like, So I like, but the thing about the Merlin books that you get, though, is that you get more of a full picture of the world of Amber. It's like, it's two things. One is he's had more time to think about it, and they'd done like the illustrated guide, so he sat down with those artists and guys and said, well, on the third floor is this room, you know, and so he's fleshed it out a little bit in his mind. He's able to put that in the book. But also, because Merlin kind of meanders his way through, you kind of see more of the sights. You know, with Corrin, it's like you see the inside of a dungeon, you see a hell ride, you see a cave, you know. But with Merlin, you see the court politics. You see the, and here's another interesting thing, too. With Merlin, you see all the princes that are his uncles in more or less peaceful conversations. With Corrin, every time Corrin encounters somebody of his relatives, you're like, are they going to kill each other? Is Corrin going to have to kill him? Is he going to imprison? You know, there's always that animosity. With Merlin, everybody's like, oh, my favorite nephew, come over here and sit down and we'll have a drink together. Which, again, if you're just wanting to enjoy the characters and the setting, it's great. If you're wanting that plot, though, you're like, oh, my God, don't have another conversation over wine, Merlin. Do something, right?
But so you're also describing the differences of things that interest you as a young man versus things that interest you as a older man.
Which is interesting because the character's the other way around.
Yeah.
As a young man, he was writing Corwin.
Yes.
And as an older man, he's writing Merlin, who's like almost a teenager, basically, right out of college.
Yes.
That's interesting, yeah. So did you say which disappointed you then? Is it the Merlin books?
I wasn't that thrilled with Shadrach, as I mentioned.
And, all right.
And, you know, I really liked his, what, the books he did, there were two books he did with another writer that were all the people from horror literature thrown together. Was that the Night of...
Night in Lonesome October was a solo, as far as I know.
No, this is one, two books that he wrote with another writer whose name's...
He finished Prince an Charming. Alfred Bester book, Psycho Shock.
Was it the Prince Charming?
It might be, yeah.
Bring Me the Head of Prince Charming?
Yeah, they were humorous. I like those, you know, but they were... You know, lesser works.
They came along a bit later on.
Yeah, but they were fun. Yeah. They were a lot of fun, and I think that's one of the things.
James, what did you think?
I haven't encountered anything yet. I still feel like I'm relatively new to Zelazny, despite having read Lord of Light, I don't know, probably 10 years ago. But I haven't finished the Amber books, and I haven't gone and read Doorways in the Sand, all the short stories, or The Last Defender of Camelot, any of that stuff yet.
Well, let me just say, the short stories are really what he was known for the most of the time until Amber. And he always was said he was a short story writer. He wrote longer stuff mainly for the money, because that was what was selling at that point, much more than short stories. And he, you know, like you were saying a minute ago, he expanded He Who Shapes into the Dream Master. He expanded And Call Me Conrad into This Immortal. By the way, And Call Me Conrad won a Hugo or Nebula for short work.
Yep.
And then he expanded into This Immortal, and it won Best Novel.
Yes.
And it won Best Novel tying Dune.
Yes.
I just always like to point that out at least once in the Zelazny panel, that one of his lesser works tied freaking Dune,
This Immortal, Dune.
Yeah.
Dune was at the time probably the longest science fiction book ever written. I mean, when it came out, because it was
large,
very massive.
Yeah,
it was very.
Today
massive.
It's just kind of average.
Oh yeah, today it's afternoon's read.
Yeah, because back then the average probably science fiction novel was about 160 pages, right?
Yeah,
and it was from words, something like
60,000
Pyramid. Yeah. You know, I have a whole mess of Pyramid fun books on my shelf, and they're easy, and they're 160 pages, and
all those Dawes. Yeah. There were zebras back then that were really small.
Yeah. A lot later,
and a lot of them were. I mean, they were serialized in the magazines, so they weren't that long.
Actually,
to begin with,
it's not entirely on topic. But when I was just starting out, I wrote the novella, which later became my first novel, and I sent it to Andy Offit. He was doing Swords Against Darkness for Red Zebra. And he wrote back saying, well, the series has been discontinued, but I think this is good. I think you should expand it into a novel, and I think you should send it to a publisher, not Zebra.
That sounds like
it. Nice. I guess I'm going to say my disappointment would be just the stuff that he wasn't able to finish before he died. It's, and again, this is nothing against Jane Linscull. She's just a different writer, a different person, and her stuff's going to be different. And so I was reading Lord Demon, and I wasn't sure whether, like, he left an outline and she wrote all of it or what the situation was mechanically. But you start reading Lord Demon, and you're like, oh, this is classic Zelazny. Oh, this is, if she co-wrote this, she's really good. It's classic Zelazny. And you get about two-thirds of the way through it, and again, you can find a sentence where you're like, okay, somebody else is writing it now. And that's fine. I mean, it's still a great book. But it, you could, I mean, he had such a distinctive voice.
Yeah.
And what's fascinating is he could be so varied with it, and yet it still, you know, it still was very noticeably him. So, okay, so we did the favorite and anything disappointing. What about his writing style? We've talked a little bit about it, but let's kind of go down the line and talk about what about his way of writing, anything specific or in general that is notable or that really appeals to you or whatever, Steve.
Well, he's very conversant with the field.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's in conversation with the genre when he's writing, and it's noticeable. You know, both direct homage stuff and the stuff he incorporates. You know, there's an old saying, mediocre writers have influences, great writers steal.
Yeah.
And,
please always to call it research.
Yes. There's one bit, and I think it's Road Marks, where...
Oh, Lord. That looks crazy.
The hero has just captured the person who's been pursuing him, and... This 30s roadster drives up, and this guy gets out, and he says, I'll take him from here. I've got the operation that'll cure his antisocial tendencies. And he picks him up, and the shirt rips.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, this bronzed guy.
Yeah. I got to say, you're talking about that book. Yes. Here's a story about that book. Road Marks only has two kinds of chapters, chapters one and chapters two. It's one, two, whatever. And he said that, and again, this is one of those things where you don't know if he's telling the truth or not, because he may have just told these things for fun. Maybe it's true. That he wrote all the book, and he took each chapter and put it in a separate envelope and shuffled them all up and then took it back out, and that's how it was published. I'm like...
I think that's actually how Stand on Zanzibar was done. But
I had forgotten about Road Marks. I've not been able to get into that one.
It's different.
Beyond a few pages. I was... I used to go to a lot of used... There was a local used bookstore in my town, and that's where I found Lord of Light. And if anybody knows anything about the SF section at a used bookstore, people get that the good stuff, and they keep it, they hoard it. All I would ever find in there, I'd go back and look for Roger Zelazny stuff after reading Lord of Light. All you'd find is like five copies of Road Marks. That was all that was in there. Nobody.
That's the only one they're bringing back.
Yeah,
right.
The only one they're reading and bringing back.
I like it.
Yes.
No, I love it. That's good stuff, but that's the last exit to Babylon.
One of the things I like about Zelazny is what you hinted about is he is able to write in the lyrical, epic fantasy style that you could say Bradbury would write this sentence that was right out of Tolkien or something like that. But then he throws modern day words at you and or maybe stuff from the 30s and all that. He's mixing all kinds of argot from, and it works. And we haven't even mentioned Damnation Alley, which was a really good, was it a story or a full novel? I can't remember. I thought it was like a long novelette.
If it wasn't one he expanded, it's a short novel.
It's a short novel. Yeah.
And a lot better than the movie. So
I was just about to mention the movie.
Who did see the movie is like, you know, I don't think that was the book I read.
Well, you ever seen the cartoon? It shows a bunch of books telling ghost stories around a campfire. And then one of them saying, and then they ripped out half her pages and turned her into a movie.
Yes.
Yeah.
I immediately thought of the Damnation Alley movie.
You know the other movie that's based on his work that is not credited? Is Dreamscape. It was based on the.
That was a good movie too.
Yeah, it was partially based on
Dream Master,
but they changed enough of it that he asked him to take his name off of it.
Ah, I did not know that.
Yeah. I haven't seen that in God.
I haven't
years.
Seen it in years either. Basic Cable in the '80s, but
I want to watch it again.
Dennis Quaid.
Yeah, yeah.
Good movie.
I remember seeing that.
The Snake Monster.
No, I don't remember.
Was really cool.
I remember almost nothing about it except that I liked it and it was cool.
A future idea for a panel. Movies that are better than their books. There are some. There really are.
Not a lot.
There are some.
It'd be a short panel.
And I think they did.
Still there are.
I think they adapted The Last Defender of Camelot for the 1985 Twilight Zone. If I remember correctly.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it.
Oh, yeah.
I saw that one.
I've got them on DVD, but I haven't.
Who
was it?
Oh, George R. R. Martin.
Oh, okay.
I think you're absolutely right, as I recall.
That's
now.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
My brain is starting to work.
That's pretty cool. Now I got to see that. I got to find that somehow.
I have it, but you don't live in Arkansas.
they did do a DVD. I have the DVD set of the first season, which was the better season. They did two seasons of that. First one was much better than the second one.
Although I think didn't the second have the great Ellison story about the Danny Kaye?
That was the first season.
Oh, that was first
season. That was Paladin of the Lost Hour.
Okay, I thought that was in the second season.
And he wrote that script for Twilight Zone and did a story to go along with it. The story's collected in the Essential Ellison.
Mm-hmm. So, James, what do you think about his writing style?
Lyrical, ornate. You're reading it, you know you're in the hands of a master craftsman. I don't know how much time he spent, you know, slaving over every word, or if that all just came naturally to him.
I think
him.
It just came flowing right out. I think it's just how he was.
I think so, too. But, you know, just Corwin is just so compelling. To wake up and not know who he is, and then he's got to trick his, you know, he's got to make everybody think he's the smartest guy in the
room.
That
opening is
and
brilliant.
He's playing everybody. But he has no idea what's going on. What is the characterization in those, the interplay with him and his snipey siblings is very...
Let's just say he's lucky that the first two relatives to deal with were Flora and Random.
That's true.
I mean, he starts really... Now, Random, of course, later becomes very, you know, commanding, but my gosh.
A great scene in Lord of Light where they're describing a religious ritual in great... He's describing in great gory detail with all these things. And then there's something about Little Joe from Kokomo, and you realize they are playing craps with dice, and that's what the religious ceremony is that the gods are doing. And I went, okay, that's funny.
I like the stuff too about the radar dishes on top of the temples because that's how the prayers get to the gods. They're actually sending signals up physically to
the spaceships
above where the Hindu pantheon lives. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's a great idea.
Fun writing.
The idea of using the mixing in the contemporary language you're talking about, Bill, that always appeals to me. It's funny because whenever I do that, people read it and go, well, you kind of messed up here because I don't think they would have used that language. I'm like, that's the point, you know. So he could get away with that, right? But anybody else does it, you're making a horrible mistake. And
I know.
Isn't that funny?
It's a skill that's really hard to... It looks easy and it ain't.
That's true. That's true, yeah.
Yeah.
But, I love the prose poetry and its pulp. I've always said he was kind of a part of a chain that goes back to Edgar Rice Burroughs and then you got Philip Jose Farmer. I mean, you know, like you have the early pulps stuff where you have heroes along the line of Corwin, but it's more straightforward, and the writing is a little more just kind of straightforward. It's not trying to do anything artistic at all, necessarily. And then, you know, with like a Philip Jose Farmer, you get the same sort of concepts that Zelazny might have used. And I know that Farmer actually outlives Zelazny, but I don't know if they're roughly the same age. But when I read Farmer, I think this is where Zelazny started and took it another level. Mm-hmm. Because if you look at like The World of Tears, right, you know, the Maker of Universes, Gates of Creation, that series, you read those and it's so amber except not as appealing, not as fun. I mean, it's still cool. I enjoy those books, but you know, you've got, you know, immortal siblings that hate each other, the missing father, all that stuff is there, but it just doesn't read as the same.
Well, they both drew from the same sources.
The Elizabethan...
Elizabethan drama, that sort of thing.
Well, and Zelazny credited, he dedicated one of the Amber books to the characters in
World of Tears?
Farmer's World of Tears, yeah.
Jaddo and... actually wrote a good introduction to one edition of the World of Tears books.
Yeah.
And,
Well, you know, and Zelazny was a better writer than Farmer, and Farmer was good, you know.
No, so, right, I think that's fair. It doesn't insult Farmer to say that. I mean, he's fine.
No.
Yeah.
And I think that Zelazny was influenced by Ray Bradbury, because Ray Bradbury was also influenced by the pulps. He grew up reading them. He loved them. It's just that when he tried to write a pulp, he wrote brilliant poetry, you know.
Yeah. Right. He wrote Lake.
That's why, you know, Ray Bradbury wrote the way he did. That was just him. He was his style, but to do the stuff.
You never would have gotten, like, the Hell Rides from a pulp thing, though, right?
No.
He took that and just kind of says, all right, we're going to spend 2.5 pages with just these ellipses and, you know, imagery using his language for imagery. Like, when I was in, like, 9th grade reading it, I'm like, oh, another Hell Ride, skip, right? But, because to me, it was like the transporter. I'll see you in a little bit.
Those are my favorite parts.
Well, see, when I was reading it when I was little, I'm like, okay, they're on the transporter on the Enterprise. I don't want to read about every molecule coming up the Enterprise. I want them to be on the Enterprise now. Whereas you go back and read it again later, and you're like, wow, you know, all the stuff, you know.
I love that from the first
A horseman time. Flashes by, lightning flaring, something from Ichabod Crane, blah, blah, blah. You know, all this stuff is going by, and you're just like, oh, my gosh.
That's one of the reasons I would love to see a miniseries, because they could do that now with morphing. And he's so visual about it. You know, a mountain rises up, and then it's cloudy, and then the sun's out, then it's nighttime, and then there's weird things trying to eat you, and...
I guess my favorite bit, I was talking about Courts of Chaos. I got to say, this is my favorite bit, one of my favorite bits from Courts of Chaos. This is along what we're talking about, is he stops his long giant, the whole Courts of Chaos is one long hell ride. And he stops, and there's like these little dwarves. And he goes into their cave with his horse, with Star. And they kind of tie Star up by the door, and he goes down, and they're going to feed him. And they keep giving him drinks, and all the little dwarves are like, everybody's great, everybody's smiling, happy. And Corwin's like, I got a little sleepy. Got a little sleepy. And it's like, that, that, that. It's like, just imagine like the Ewoks all celebrating, right? Yes. Well, it's going to be, right?
Right before they eat him.
Right. So then he kind of nods over and he looks up and they're all, da, 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 da. He nods over again. He looks up, da, da, da. Nods over again, looks up, and they're all coming at him with knives and forks, going. Yeah. And he's like, oh! and like the butcher's got Star going off toward the kitchen, like, oh, hold on. So, yeah, I love stuff like that, where he could combine humor and action and drama and the language and the way that he constructed it visually for you is really remarkable. So, another thing is a lot of his themes were immortals and gods, right? He loved to play with immortals and gods, but he'd make them human. And you're talking about that vernacular. The language really lent itself to that. Mm-hmm. So, and by the way, speaking of that, I'm working on, just at the very beginning, well, I'll go ahead and learn just another book, but we're going to do a book using the themes of Zelazny's Immortals, but it's not going to be Zelazny related. It's just going to be using those ideas, and it's going to be called These Immortals. So I have that coming up in a year or two. I'm very excited about that.
Yes, definitely homage, right?
Absolutely. And another thing I'm going to point out is if you like Zelazny, and I'll say this before I forget because we've got about 10 or 12, 15 minutes left, if you like Zelazny, his stuff is in print in different ways. James, you've been getting him on ebook because the family is now in control of Amber, and they're
finally releasing those and decently Kindle. Priced.
With Kindle. Good covers.
Good covers.
With good covers, finally.
They're excellent covers.
I've always said the one thing that the Amber books really lacked was covers that had anything to do with what was inside. I mean, 9 out of every 10 at least. You got the one that came out back in the 80s, I think, that had Corwin in silver and black.
Yeah.
But other than that, it's like a knight on a horse with a lance or something, and you're like, this is like Camelot.
And that's after him spoon-feeding the cover
the
artist.
Visual,
how easy, because everybody has their own color and with the trunks.
Absolutely. It's
that
so
would have
visual.
Been so easy to do.
Well, you know, covers have improved out of all recognition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know. The stuff that they used to put on your covers. Let's not have a bitch session about covers.
Indie writers will talk about, how do I get a good cover? Well, one of the things you do is you put stuff in there that would make a good cover, that's going to inspire the artist to go, hey, I need to...
And even then,
you still might end up with a rocket ship or a dragon.
Let us look from a publisher's point of view. What's the definition of good cover? one sells. That makes you buy the book.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Sells. You know, if it has nothing to do with the book, but you still bought it because of the cover, score.
Got a point. It's not an illustration.
Yeah. Right. It's true. But still, you know, you'd like it to have some semblance of relevance to say, the...
You know, I think there could have been a good cover.
It becomes false advertising if it has no semblance whatsoever of relevance.
Was it who wrote A Woman of the Iron People?
I don't remember.
Is that a Jean M. All book? That sounds like one of hers.
No, sound like that. Yeah.
Vonda McIntyre, I think.
Yeah,
and she once told me that about her cover, and she said somewhere there's a book, when the book is about a hooker with purple hair, and it has a bear-like alien on the cover.
Well, you know, for years...
Yeah, because that does happen. They just switch...
For years, they would put gorillas on the cover of comic books, even if there weren't any gorillas in the story, because somebody figured out that they sold better when they had gorillas on the cover.
Yeah, and they put a dragon or a swastika on a book cover.
Oh, yeah, my friend Brad. If you put a swastika on the cover, you can be sold.
You just can't sell it in Germany.
Yeah, well.
And you may not want to meet any of your readers.
That's true.
Oh, no. Because people who hate Nazis love to buy books about Nazis.
Well, what I would say, the other thing that you can get them in is that the New England Science Fiction Association, I guess, NESFA. Yeah, they put out 6 beautiful hardcovers a few years ago, and they're still kind of floating around. They've got a single... Michael Whelan cover, and when you put all 6 on the shelf, the cover is the whole painting is there, rectangular on the spines, because each book is about that thick. And
yeah, that's like the collected short fiction of all of it.
Right, it's got it's even got all the Amber stories that were in like the Amber Zine and things like that that had never been collected before.
So I hope to get those.
There's like 6 of them.
Not all of them yet, because you've been reading them. What are they up to, like?
They're up to Hand of Oberon, because that's the last one I finished. Now, you can get, there was a publishing outfit a few years ago called iBooks, not to be confused with Apple.
Yeah.
They did print editions, too. You can find those editions in ebook for, like, they're like $7.99. They're what you
They did a bunch of paperbacks, too. I've got a bunch of them.
But it's not the Amber stuff. It's like Doorways in the Sand and The Last Defender of Camelot.
Audible's also been putting out Amber,
Lord of Light, stuff like that,
on audio lately. They had the Corwin series is read by Alessandro Giuliani from Battlestar Galactica, Gaeta. He does a pretty good job with it. And the Merlin ones are read by, I think, Will Wheaton, which is awesome. So,
that's cool.
Because he did Ready Player One, which is a fantastic audio book. So.
And I know that I have a couple of the SF Book Club editions of the Omnibus Amber series.
So with the Boris books. Cover, which again has very little.
Yeah, but that's just a Boris the headline around.
It does have a guy with a sword fighting two giant cats, which is in the books. He's just wearing red and blue, and I'm like, no!
I think that's coincidentally.
Not red and blue. That's what James was saying. When the whole point is that they have colors,
yes.
Right. I don't know who red and blue is, but it ain't Corwin, so...
Questions from
the... Oh, yeah, let's get this one.
...whatsoever to the book is actually somewhat miraculous.
Yes.
That's true. That's fair. Yeah. Especially back then. Yes, ma'am.
What short story best embodies his writing?
Oh, man.
That's a hard one.
Last Unicorn.
Last Unicorn's good.
I
don't know.
Well, you know, that reminds... The what's the one where he plays chess with the...
Unicorn Variations.
You know, the great deal about that is that he had written, George R. R. Martin tells this story, that he was asked to write a story for a book about unicorns. He was asked to write a story for a book about chess, and there was one other, I can't remember what it was, in a bar. And George says to him, you should write a story about a guy playing chess with a unicorn in a bar. And George's like, oh, that's funny, and he goes home and does it.
Yeah.
And sold it to all 3. And it's good. Yeah, and it became the cover of that anthology. Yeah.
The story's like he went to he was going on a cruise, so he bought a book on chess. And when he went on the cruise, he wrote the story on the cruise.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I like it because it has his mythology, his snarkiness, and yet it's still very much rooted in modern.
Yeah, you know what? A lot of his earlier short stories were just science fiction, and I don't think they represent him properly. I mean, they're good, but I just don't think of him as primarily a science fiction. I mean, he didn't really do, unless you count the very last one where he was basically Tron, kind of, that was finished by Jane Linscold.
Donnerjack.
Donnerjack. I get it and Shadowjack confused. Yeah. Donnerjack was as science fictiony as he ever really got later on, other in his long fiction. Long for him, right? Whereas his short fiction, the early, is more science fictiony, or even planetary romance in a way, sort of, kind of.
Once again, that's probably the marketing.
Remember,
a certain event happened that caused this big fantasy revolution in science fiction publishing, which was the publication of Lord of the Rings in paperback.
Yeah, that changed everything.
Yes, sir, right here.
Talking about the difference between story and cover and all, I think one of the best examples of that is a book about a professor who writes a story, and when it gets published, the book and the name and everything are completely different than that symbol.
Oh, that's Sharon McCrum.
Sharon McCrum.
I'm not familiar with that.
Oh, it's a mystery novel that takes place at a science fiction convention.
Right. Yeah, and it's an author everyone hates gets murdered there.
It's a thinly disguised Harlan Ellison, by the way.
Yeah.
He wrote a serious book about something, and the publisher put a picture of a scantily clad woman on the front talking to scientists.
Yes.
Based on a minor detail.
So a scene from the end of that Pierce Brosnan James Bond movie. Got it. Okay.
In the book, the author is a professor at a local college, and he writes a hard science fiction, or you know, more science than fiction story, and they publish it as Bimbos of the Dead.
I got you. That's good. I have to check that out.
And that became the name of the mystery novel because it was easy.
If you want the ultimate horror story, yes. Carl Wagner got a publisher who. Did one of his Kane books, and they had a stock photo of a black guy in a horned helmet with a sword and a loincloth, and they put it on the cover, and then they decided to change his hero from a blue-eyed redhead mm-hmm. to a black guy to suit the cover without mm-hmm. telling him, but they didn't do it consistently.
Oh no.
Because, I thought that Carl Wagner was the hero of his that story, because you know, that's the way he looked.
Yeah.
He had, amazing amount of long red hair.
so they didn't tell him, and they didn't do it consistently. So that he's a blue eyed redhead in some chapters, and he's black in the others.
But it's fantasy, so hey, you know.
Anyway,
it happens.
The ability to change races.
Yeah. What do you think was Roger's best cover for any of his stuff?
There's memorable ones that are, I don't know they're necessarily best, but like I said, the Last Exit to Babylon, what's the name of the book?
Roadmarks.
Roadmarks, yeah. I mean, just the idea of a pickup truck going down the road.
And there a dragon.
And a dragon flying overhead.
That was a good...
And the sign says Last Exit to Babylon has a little ziggurat. It's just very simple.
Is that Don Mates, I think, perhaps?
But that one really stands out to me. Mm-hmm. Again, like I said, the Amber covers... Now, again, the Kindle cover for the new Guns of Avalon has Corwin.
I love that cover. That cover's so awesome.
Like in silver armor with an AK-47 or an M16.
Kind of,
yeah. And I'm like, now they got it. That's what you need is a fantasy figure holding a machine gun.
They got it. All the covers for the new ebooks so far are great.
I'm going to get a copy of that.
Rose for Ecclesiastes
mm-hmm.
made the cover of Fantasy and Science Fiction the year it came out. That's a great cover. I want to say it was by Freeze. I'm almost positive it was a Kelly cover. But it's in my brain, so that's not necessarily true. Because if it's in my brain, it's subject to it.
I have stars in the background.
I'm just going to say, I love the mid-70s black covers
mm-hmm.
that
Lord of Light.
That Ace Lord of Light. Did. Yeah. That were black with mm-hmm. the big white letters, and that's what they were trying. You can kind of see here. I told Warren, I said, I like the font you used. It reminds me of
those Ace covers.
Those covers, that's what we were aiming for.
Avon.
I thought those were really good. Yeah. Let me get this gentleman over here now. You had a chance.
You mentioned the Audible stuff.
Yeah.
Speaking Volumes is another company that does audiobooks, and they've got. The first Chronicles and the first four volumes of the Merlin series, Unabridged, read by Zelazny.
Oh.
Yeah. He read them too. The audio quality is not as great as some of the stuff being done now, but I love those too.
Pre-digital,
analog tape. It was recorded on.
Right.
They've done a really good digital transfer. The original cassette stuff and the original Abridged CDs that came out in the 90s were kind of the digital technology has really cleaned it up. I've gotten the first two volumes. They're good. They, of course, won't be able to release the 10th volume, Red by Zelazny, because
he
never recorded it before he passed away. And his voice is kind of shaky in the ninth volume. Mm-hmm. So their recommendation is, if you want to hear Zelazny read it, get the speaking volumes versions. It's speaking-volumes.us, or you can just Google for Zelazny unabridged audiobook. And they recommend Will Wheaton's Audible version
for the last one. Do they include the little sort of folk music in between the chapters? Okay.
No, they removed all the music.
Removed all that stuff. The barking dogs and the clanging swords.
All that stuff out. It is just Zelazny, and they even specifically say, no, that was a poor decision
in
the first versions. We've gotten rid of it. It's just Zelazny reading the book.
Yeah, in the original version, they'd be like, Zelazny's reading about a sword fight, and you hear clang, 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 oh, clang, clang in the background. You're kind of going, I kind of get what you're doing here, but I don't know if we really
need
it.
Yeah, there's audio drama, and then there's reading.
You don't need both.
You can't put them together.
It's a poor editorial decision originally. New people that, nope, it's all Zelazny.
That's pretty good.
Put your own in if you want.
Put your own in. Yes, sir, right here.
I had a question that I sort of wanted to put to the panel. One of the things I always found fascinating about Zelazny's books is how you could tell when he wrote a book, because he was so aware of the cultural zeitgeist at the time he was writing things. And in fact, I think that's one of the biggest reasons for the difference between the Corwin and the Merlin novels.
Okay.
The Corwin novels were written in the 70s, the Merlin novels were written in the late 80s and the 90s, and the time was different. I mean, for example, in the 70s, people actually had sex. By the time you get to the 90s, you went through the whole 80s, everyone is terrified of sex.
Yes.
And everybody smoked cigarettes, too.
Yeah, everybody smoked cigarettes and drank like a fish. By the time you get to the Corwin novels, it's all, let's have a little wine.
Yeah, you're right.
The question I kind of wanted to put to the panel is, do any of the rest of you sort of see that as something that added to, or just, how do you think that influenced some of his books, the sense of the time they were written in? Yeah. Is that something that is obvious and beneficial, or?
I think it's obvious in the, at least the first two Amber books, because when he comes to himself, he's in our world. And yeah, you can tell he wrote this in, you know, the early 70s, because, you know, he's smoking in a hospital. Who does that anymore? and describing the clothes that they would wear and stuff. But I just, you know, I took that as, yeah, that's when he wrote this book. But when it gets out of that, it could be,
you're right, it does,
just anything.
It does. Terry Bisson makes a good point about this. He adapted the Nine Princes in Amber and Guns of Avalon for DC for the comic book, for the graphic novel. And he said he made the decision back when he wrote the adaptation, the script, to leave all the smoking out. And he says now he regrets it, because he says that really was part of the flavor of that story.
It grounded it, yeah.
And it's gone. It is more. It seems more fantasy and less a fantasy guy on Earth than it would if he was just like standing around going, you know, like that. So, yeah.
I'm a fervent anti-smoker, but it really pisses me off when I see a movie made in America for the 1940s as its setting, and no one's smoking in it. It's like, no, this didn't happen. Mm. You know, there weren't people who, there may have been an individuals, but it was ubiquitous.
Yeah.
You know, as an example. And I think you need to, when you're trying to do something that's set in this period, you need to capture it.
Yeah.
So if you're writing in that period, it's easy to capture. When you're writing outside of the period about it, it's harder to capture.
Yeah. Things change. I mean, you know, people smoked all the time. If you look at old movies from the 30s and 40s, even things like how people got into a car.
Yeah, changed. Different. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you could walk into a car as opposed to dropping yourself down and into it.
Right. Yeah. Because they were bigger. Yeah.
Because they were bigger. You stepped up on the running board and got in the car.
We got time for one more. Yes, sir. You've been having your hand up.
Real quick, you mentioned the beautiful six hardback collection of Whelan. Highly recommended if you don't have it. There is a seventh volume. It's paperback only.
The bibliography.
If you're a collector, it lists all of the different publications and appearances in magazines of all of the short stories where they've been collected in print, and all the different versions. Shows even different cover art for the different versions of the books published, and it's cheaper than the hardbacks. It continues the painting. And again, I highly recommend.
Cool. Yeah, and I would point out, if you really like Amber and you don't know, there's two books out there. There's the Illustrated Guide to Castle Amber that Zelazny collaborated on with the artists and the writers, so it's official. And there's the Diceless role-playing game books. Those have amazing artwork all the way through them with the different princes and princesses and everything. It has also a lot of background information about it. I don't know how canonical it is compared to some, but it's really good stuff. Yeah, so I always recommend that, too, if you can find it. It's not the easiest thing to find.
The print versions, good luck. They go.
I've got one, but yeah.
But the electronic editions are available for sale.
You okay.
You can get them on RPG Drive-Thru.
Drive-Thru RPG, okay.
Drive-Thru RPG,
yeah.
Thank you.
All right, well, I think we're about out of time. Thanks, everybody, for coming, and yay, Raj Lesnar. All right,
thank you, guys. Thank you.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.